On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
So now, compulsory purchase orders, road widening schemes, controversial redevelopment that grinds the city to a halt. It all sounds very modern, doesn't it? It all sounds like you're building the Lewis Line or you're maybe trying to power through Bus Connect. It all sounds very 21st century. But amidst all the talk about Merchant's Arch and Temple Bar that there's been in the last week, there hasn't been quite as much talk about the organisation that put the arch there in the first place. But in fact, one of the most transformative organisations in the history of city planning anywhere in the world actually did all of its business in Dublin. No single organisation reshaped this place quite like a body called the Wide Streets Commissioners, although not everyone liked their work, although we still see that work every day. Donald Fallon has been putting on his best urban heritage hat and has come in to try and unload all of this history on us. Donald, good to see you.
Great to see you back in that seat. I'm amazed I got you out here for even a fortnight.
Even a fortnight, yeah. I think the daughter is at home kind of wondering, God, where the hell is that lad gone? Merchant's Arch, as both an archway and a sort of a passageway. Important to stress when we talk about all this that the arch itself isn't going anywhere.
Absolutely, yeah. That is very, very important. Merchant's Arch, you know, it's a beautiful archway. It kind of links the Halfpenny Bridge and Liffey Street on the north side with kind of Crown Alley and Temple Bar on the south side. No one is talking about demolishing that. There's no risk of that being removed from the streetscape. What is in question, I suppose, is the construction of a new hotel further within the laneway. And confusingly, the entire laneway is known as Merchant's Arch.
Okay.
So that's where this confusion all comes from. But one thing about this kind of debate and the cobblestone as well, I know there was a significant protest in Dublin yesterday around that development, is that it's opened up a lot of discussion about the city, about overdevelopment. And I think people debating those things, that's always a good thing to be. But what people don't know is how the arch ended up there. And that is the story of this incredible body of people, the Wide Streets Commissioners, or to give them their full title, their mouthful title. The Commissioners for Making Wide and Convenient Ways, Streets and Passages. What a name that is.
At least it does what it says on the tin. I mean, there's no sort of debating around whether, like, you're not just a modernisation group and people are debating what modernisation means. At least it's fairly clear what these guys are trying to do.
Yeah, and what we find in their story, it's incredible. You're one of the earliest town planning authorities on their scale in the world who had this real vision of kind of turning a town, and that's what it was, Dublin. It was a town into you know, a place that really couldn't shake off the historic cobwebs and grow into a metropolis. And it's pretty much impossible to walk anywhere in this city, even today, without walking through their vision and down some of their streets.
And all of this is happening so long ago that it's all, you know, really remarkably early by any stretch. And even before Paris famously got down to redeveloping itself, Dublin was already taking a head start.
Yeah, and look, you can't preserve everything. Cities have to move forward, they have to evolve. And if cities don't move forward, they're no longer fit for purpose. You know, everything changes, commerce changes, transport changes, there's all kinds of things. You need to house more people. You know, there's a whole host of things that mean cities have to change. But probably the most celebrated kind of city planning of the modern age was Paris, the great houseman. He just reinvented the place. And you know the beautiful kind of open airiness of Paris today?
Yes.
That arrives thanks to this planner houseman. Before him, it was not a city of romance, to say the least, but kind of wide avenues and boulevards. Paris was described before him as overcrowded, dingy, dirty, riddled with disease. But to put our story today in context, this guy houseman only started that work in Paris at a time when the Wide Streets Commissioners in Dublin had already been folded up in the 1850s. So Dublin is a century ahead of Paris and ahead of basically all European capitals, including London, and asking itself these kind of very, very important questions. How do you make a city fit for purpose and fit for people to live in?
Just when you said the words overcrowded, dingy, dirty and riddled with disease, just really reminded me of Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge.
It sounds like a bad TripAdvisor review for the contemporary city.
One out of five would not go again, dingy and riddled with disease. The time when all of this is happening in Dublin is a time from when there's a real appetite towards thinking big.
Yeah, modernity is kind of knocking on the door, you know, by the mid-18th century. And Dublin is kind of starting to see itself as the second city of the empire, but it doesn't feel like a great city of empire. I mean, it has all kinds of problems, the biggest of which, I think, is its just inability to grow. Like when Trinity College eventually opens in the late 16th century, they officially call it the college near to Dublin because it's beyond the walls of Dublin.
Yeah.
Dublin is still a very small space.
Dublin's down in the kind of the Wood Quay area down there. That's the city centre at the time.
Absolutely. And the kind of Wide Streets Commissioners, their job is, it's a bold attempt to change that. And they had extensive powers with the authority to acquire property by compulsory purchase, always popular even today, demolish it, lay down new streets and set lots along the new streets for builders to develop. So most of its members kind of came from the merchant class, you know, business owners or minor gentry, as they would have said, the captains of industry of their day. And this was their task, reimagine Dublin. And most of them had been on what they called the Grand Tour. So they were influenced by the continent.
Yeah, and this is the Grand Tour before the era of Amazon in Prime and Mr. Clarkson and his chums. This is like, this is the, I suppose it's almost like the Interrailing or the J1 of its day, the Grand Tour that some of these guys would have been.
Yeah, it's the Erasmus of its day. And, you know, in the age of Ryanair, the Grand Tour no longer sounds quite as exotic. You can jump on a flight anywhere at the moment for buttons. But in the 18th century, it was an amazingly privileged thing to do. I mean, to get off this island and to travel Europe. Most people never made it to the other side of their own island, you know, never mind the continent. But the Grand Tour was a kind of rite of passage for kind of upper class young men when they came of age. Normally, they were accompanied by a chaperone, and they would go to all the great cities of Europe, you know, and it put Europe and its styles into the heads of young men.
Okay.
So it had all kinds of effects on young minds. One guy writes home from Venice of how he had encountered, quote, "more handsome women this day than I ever saw in my life."
That's the really important interrailing aspect of it.
Know, most of these people weren't travelling around the continent of Europe to look at young ones. You know, they were going to look at other things too, buildings, streetscapes, and to get a sense of kind of continental development. So yeah, the Grand Tour really influences, I think, the thinking of this class of people in 18th century Dublin.
I suppose that is something that is worth stressing though, because when you're from a time where the city that you grow up in is probably the only town that you're ever really going to know, and you just presume that that way of laying out streets or having narrow footpaths or whatever is the only way that you can design a city, and then suddenly to be presented with all of the other civilizations of Western Europe and to realize what they're capable of doing, it really broadens your mind. When the work of this Wide Streets Commission begins, it does shift the city entirely in a new direction.
Yeah, what they would do for Dublin most significantly, I think, was that they shift the entire axis of the city. So Dublin had been kind of very east-west, a city with kind of very extreme poverty in the area we now know as kind of Smithfield, Church Street on the north side, and then the kind of medieval birthplace on the south side and into the Liberties, but very little beyond that. And it was very, very slow to get moving. But the Wide Streets Commissioners, they shift the axis of the city really north-south. So that means lots of development further down the River Liffey. And to give one example everyone will know, they build the Carlisle Bridge, which is now the O'Connell Bridge. So that moves the axis of the city from, say, Capel Street to what we now know as O'Connell Street. Okay. Dublin is kind of moving east the whole time. And the extent of their work that survives is incredible. Even coming here today, I walked down one of their streets, Parliament Street. You know, still there.
That's one of theirs. And leading up to City Hall.
Very beloved in recent times because it's been, you know, the very successful run at pedestrianisation on that street. Mm. But I love when you come down Capel Street and you look across the river and you have that perfect vista of City Hall. Mm. I mean, that's their work. Initially, it was to connect Capel Street and Dublin Castle, okay, but it's still one of the great views of Dublin. Then they dramatically kind of widen Dame Street and they give us entirely new streets. And what's great about them is, with kind of modesty typical of the time and of their own class, they name the streets after themselves and their beneficiaries. Beresford, Gardner, Dalier, you know, all these 18th century Dublin streets reflect the contribution of these men themselves. But they kind of saw Dublin, you know, one friend of mine, an architect, she calls it Lego blocks of the rich, which it kind of was. They saw it as a kind of manageable, controllable unit. And if something wasn't working, you could clear it and go again.
That answers actually one question that I've wondered about for a long time, which is where exactly some of those street names came from. Because I know there's some street names, like I think, Dawson Street? The Dawsons were the people who originally inhabited the Mansion House once upon a time, or that there's some sort of aristocracy family, so it's named after them. I never knew who Mr. Beresford or Mr. Gardner or Mr. Dalier was, but now that answers the question. One other point, by the way, you mentioned the what is now O'Connell Bridge, which I think is unusual among bridges for being wider than it is long.
Almost exactly the same, but slightly wider.
Yeah, which I suppose is as good an illustration as any of a Wide Streets Commission, how wide they actually wanted their streets to be. Not everyone was happy, though, to be kind of moved along in the name of progress. And, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of resistance to people being bulldozed out of the way, even if this did provide inspiration for other cities.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely less popular with the city's working classes. You know, tenements and kind of narrow passageways replaced with these new wide streets, retail units. So, you know, where do we go was kind of the question some people had in the 18th century city. But I mean, the commissioners are, you know, what they're looking at was being explored in other places too. Westport, for example. Westport's beautiful in terms of town planning. Laid out in the mid-18th century. It still has a kind of distinctive Georgian feel and the logic of the planner William Leeson to it when you walk through Westport today. Waterford, Cork, they both look at Dublin and say, maybe this could work here. You get Wide Streets Commissions in those cities. And in Waterford, they're appointed to improve the city, quote, "as the streets, lanes and passages of the city of Waterford are too narrow by means whereof the health of the inhabitants is greatly injured and the trade of said city is greatly obstructed." So people in other Irish cities look at the example of the Wide Streets Commissioners and say, oh, we can do that here. But the problem with Dublin is, how many people live in it. You know, even then, it's packed. And that brings unique problems, because when you move streets, you move people, and they're not always entirely happy to go.
So we're talking, of course, about the second half of the 1700s, and then you have this spectacular fall, which people might be able to foresee coming when you talk about that timeline, and that renders these commissioners pretty obsolete.
Yeah, I mean, what's even more sudden than the rise of the city is its demise, and I don't think anyone could have envisioned a parliament that would abolish itself. It's so ludicrous, but that's exactly what happens in Dublin. They vote themselves out of a job. And when Parliament shuts itself, there's an exodus. People always talk about the exodus of wealth. No one really talks about the exodus of influence. You know, a city that no longer has a Parliament. Is it really the second city of an empire anymore? I would argue not. So the Wide Streets Commissioners, they're still working in the 19th century, but they're working with lighter pockets in a city that has less and less influence all the time. So Merchants Arch is really late in their project, 1821. That's 21 years after the Act of Union. But it's brilliant when you look at it. There's real logic to it. I mean, they allow this merchant's hall to be built, a workers' guild hall, now a bar and restaurant, on the provision that there's a public access way and passageway included.
Okay.
And it links what's then a brand new bridge, the Halfpenny Bridge, 1816, with what's the centre of industry. You know, Dublin's industrial area at that time is Temple Bar. So it makes great sense to connect this new bridge to a centre of industry.
So I suppose in a funny way then, to subvert the chat that everyone's having right now, the arch itself is actually... kind of, it was originally conceived as private property, because they're saying, right, if you're going to have a development there, you're going to have to make a space through it that people can walk through.
Absolutely, yeah. And it looks great. You know, when you stand on the Halfpenny Bridge and you look at it, I think it really adds life and character to the building. And what's weird about this debate that's going on now about Merchant's Arches, it's 1821, so it's two centuries exactly.
Oh, yeah.
This year. So happy birthday to you. You know, a great big debate to mark your 200th birthday. But the weird thing about this is, but 1851, three decades later, the Wide Streets Commissioners are just gone. I mean, they're wound down. Their powers are transferred to Dublin Corporation. Their day had passed. And I think there is a kind of irony in how sentimental historians of Dublin are about them, because, you know, in the words of one commentator, they were the very embodiment of unsentimental utility. They were willing to knock down anything that stood in the way of progress as they saw it. And now we're arguing, you know, to save their work.
That we have to retain everything that they did. I suppose what recent days have shown us again, and you mentioned that the number of people who turned out yesterday to save Merchant's Arch and the cobblestone pub in Smithfield, what it's shown us is that people are definitely interested in these kinds of questions again.
Yeah, and it's worth saying in the case of the cobblestone, it's a bit like Merchant's Arch. Like, no one is proposing knocking down the cobblestone. The main bar of the cobblestone is safe. It's the back venue, it's the side. And it's really this question of how do buildings interact with each other? You know, how do new developments interact with what's already there? And it would seem, based on that, was a really significant protest yesterday. I watched it going through town, that we're living in a time when, you know, these questions, planning, development, overdevelopment, there's a great word that's kind of now in political debate. It's interesting people here, and people are submitting observations. And by the way, you pay to do that. You pay 20 quid to submit an observation on a plan.
You have to pay to
development.
Do that.
Yes,
really?
So people are reaching into their pockets.
But it's kind of mad that if you might be like a next door neighbour to these things, and you're like, well, I don't want my neighbour to build a giant veranda that overlooks my yard, and I have to pay 20 quid to tell the council that I don't want it.
That you're willing to pay 20 quid says, you know, you care about it. And it's quite a remarkable occurrence how much people seem to care about these developments that are on the table. So what we build, where we build it, who we build it for, they're all really important questions in any city. And look, the Wide Streets Commission, they surely take pride, I think, in how much of what they built and designed remains in place. It's one of the great success stories of urban planning.
It's funny that when you see some other cities that have been more developed in more recent times, the likes of Dubai, or even people who might have seen some of the shots around Baku before the Republic of Ireland's match there yesterday, you can see that influence is still there, where people decide, right, you want to build a big city and you want to have these giant promenades as wide as possibly can be. And even now you see Paris getting redeveloped again. I can't imagine, though, that the White Streets Commissioners had much to say about, you know, proliferating of hotels here, there and everywhere. Wouldn't necessarily have been a big problem.
I don't
in the
think
second
Dublin
half
was on many people's ground tour back then.
Maybe it should be now. Donald Fallon, a presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on the history of this grand Hibernian metropolis, thank you very much for dropping in. Donald is also the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia and of the Come Here to Me books.
On the Record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk